Welcome to Forging Links. Forging Links is the voice of European social democratic activists with an Anglo-Dutch flavor. The podcast is an initiative of A Union and the platform aiming to empower political activists by developing their skill sets, sharing their stories, and generating social, environmental, economic impact. We're trying to promote the idea of politics with love, solidarity, and prosperity. If you want to know more about A Union, you can visit our website. We'd like to take this opportunity to thank Dunn Street and the people from Socially Democratic Podcast who have helped us behind the scene, our producer, Mike, and most importantly, you for listening. So enjoy. Thank you very much. Roy Zylstra, how you doing, mate?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So today we're going to talk about your life as a political agent on this planet, how you're trying to make things different and have an impact and impression on the people in your area, in Zeeland, where you live, and people in education. And then hopefully we're going to learn more about your plans and aspirations on in Europe. So who is Roy?
My name is Roy Zylstra. I am 29 years old. I was born in a small city called Goes in the province of Zeeland. And right now I'm living in an even smaller town. And we call it Stavenisse in the principality of Tholen.
Excellent. But that tells us all the facts.
Yes.
But, you know, what's more of something that you are, that makes you different to others in that sense?
I am more than 2 years a member of the PVDA, and in the time I witnessed the cooperation with GroenLinks in our province, I was member after 3 months only in the voting for my municipality in Tholen, and I was appointed as burgercommissielid. And now, after a few months after the provincial election, I also were announced as a burgercommissielid in my province of Zeeland.
Burgercommissielid.
Yes.
It
sounds
fancy title. What is that?
it sounds very fancy, but it's not. It's very practical title, because what this is very simple. Burgercommissielid in stead of gemeenteraadslid or member of state in this case. What it means is that you have all the opportunities to ask questions, say something about different subjects, but you cannot do one thing that they can do. That's voting. And the simple thing is why people like me are around is that gemeenteraadslid, staatslid, or sometimes even a secondary chamber member cannot know everything, say everything about every subject. And there were me and a lot of guys like me are jumping in for to help around and make your political opinion on all subjects noticed.
So it's almost like being an expert or somebody who adds more value to the whole discussion but doesn't necessarily vote. I mean, in the UK, we have something similar. These are like committees. These are like accountability committees. Mm. And from there, we have people who are elected members who are not necessarily executives, backbenchers, or you could say. And you also have members of the public who can add value, who can add opinions, or can pull in more information.
Yeah, the only difference, I think, with the UK in this part is that burgercommissielid in the Netherlands is also a pool for training-wise to get known by the way how it works in politics. And also when somebody steps down, you are the first following up for this position.
Oh, I see.
So in this case,
so it's almost like a backup to...
Yeah, you're indeed the first backup, and that's why in the Netherlands we keep people like me very close inside of the political arena. So when somebody drops out, you can very fast have somebody with all the knowledge ready to jump in.
I'll just be clear, is this a paid role, a remunerated role?
No, it's not a paid one. It's one you get, like a very small compensation for, around, in my municipality, it's like 150 euros each 3 months. And in the province, it's like 360 each month. But it's not like a normal paid role. It's more like... to have your drive, your distances, which
expenses paid
yeah,
for,
yeah, expenses such, indeed yeah, yeah. covered by it, and it's not like now you're doing this, yeah, you got a lot of money. No, it's not working like that. It's more the time that you need to invest in it. It's approximately 15 to 20 hours when a commission is getting started. I need to do a wrap up of 20 hours before that to know exactly what I'm going to say, know everything, and also get in contact with people that maybe know things that I still do not know on that moment. So yeah, it's going to take a lot of time, but it's not very cost wisely to attend it.
Excellent. So before we get deep into the politics, as of course we're going to talk about, what are you passionate about outside of politics?
I'm I'm a history teacher from my origin. So yeah, let's start with that. I love my history.
So that's your living, like as a living, you.
Yeah, that's
you
that's
teach.
That's indeed my job, and that's also the reason why I joined politics in the first place. But yeah, I really love the history of how our nation was built up, on what kind of parts it was built up, and also the big events that made us as a population how we are right now. And that's really one of the things I love the most. Next to teaching, of course, otherwise I will not be a teacher. And sometimes even I'm kind of a nerd and love history. That sometimes I even wear up in complete medieval armor and train even sword plays. Yeah, I do that. That's really. I also brew with a friend of mine a couple of beers, and yeah, I also like the game of Dungeons and Dragons because I'm a dungeon master in my free time if I have. I know my main subject that I get my degree on, it was early Middle Ages, and because of that, the High Middle Ages, I know a lot of things, how to make your armor, but also the ways how they fought in that time. Right now I'm learning the ways of the German swordsmanship. And it's really difficult, and sometimes it's even so difficult that I cannot, with my body that's not that one anymore of a 19 or 18 years old, can do anything with a 13 kilograms armor on. But then you can very fast understand why it looks like in knight is slow. But he isn't at all, because his armor, his way to get around with his sword combating, yeah, it really is all very good thought of how to use it. It's the best way.
So when you're, this is a bit of a side topic. I mean, this is really interesting for me. So
I understand.
You do like more like role, not necessarily role play, but as in like reenactments.
Sometimes
some events and
yeah, I go to some festivals, do something like that, but it's more not like going on a stage and do it. I'm wearing the armor, and sometimes as a sport, I also try to learn the ways. I'm teaching it most myself, but I have a sparring partner when I'm trying to use it sometimes with, but most of the times it's Yeah, I'm only doing it in very occasional wise. Not it's
have you
not
ever
like...
have you ever gone to school with an armor on? Have your kids seen you?
I am the kind of history teacher that the way I started, it was in the south of Rotterdam in IJsselmonde, and the people that live there are in the really poor side of our nation, and therefore if you're going to teach something about the Roman period, the medieval period, or even the Dutch golden age, I'm trying to dress up. I'm trying to dress up like one of those guys. And yeah, what happening then is that the children are looking like, oh my God, what is this? Yeah, this is a Roman dress or a medieval dress, and this is the way they're holding it. And I don't know, but always if I have my medieval armor on, they like to smack it because they want to see it if it's true steel or something. I don't know.
But it's better they hit it than they start biting it like, ah, this is it real?
Yeah.
Okay, so do you toss them a sack of coins and say, you know what, now you need to study, you little munchkins?
No, most of the times when I'm trying to teach them something like that, I like to give them an example. And then the whole 50 minutes I walk as a knight or a Roman or even a pirate. Yeah, I don't give something about it. But when my students, I see they are more active, they love it, the lessons. And after that, I see that they get higher grades. So I'm thinking, yeah, like...
That's amazing. That's amazing.
What do I get? Hands-on.
I mean, that's incredible because, I mean, if you look at, you know, making education more relatable in that case, making it more real. There are a few outdoor museums in the Netherlands, across the Netherlands, that do that kind of. I think Archeon, you have Old Village in near Eindhoven.
Mm-hmm.
These all are places.
Yeah, but if you are in a school that is in the south of Rotterdam, in the area of IJsselmonde, our students don't have any money to go there. The school just getting by. And that's why you need to bring it to them. But I really did, approximately 1.5 years ago, I quit there because I want to work closer at home. Now I don't need to dress up anymore. So yeah, that's a sad thing, but also for me personal, something better. But right now I'm giving lessons to school dropouts, and I'm trying to get them by in the same way I did it in the past with my pupils in the south of Rotterdam.
Very cool. So what's what got you into politics then? You could have just, you know, like you could have just stayed there being a teacher. You're adding value daily to students' lives. Why spend that time trying to do add more to your already stressful time?
Yeah, that's going to be a tough story to tell, but I'm going to tell it anyway. Approximately 3 years ago, when I got my degree as a teacher, I was working in, what I said before, in south of Rotterdam in the area of IJsselmonde. What I saw at that school truly shocked me. It was poverty on a scale I cannot imagine that even happening in our country. Children of the age of 12, they did not have a lunch the day because, the parents of them cannot afford it. They didn't have any money for it. And pupils sometimes even wear 5 days a week the same clothes because their parents didn't have enough money to get them new clothes because they're growing so fast. And also some pupils even went away one day after another because the rent and the service costs included with it, with renovations of their house, was too high. So they needed to move elsewhere. Yeah, I saw that for, didn't have my degree yet. I was seeing that for approximately 3 years. After I got my degree, I was thinking two things. I can do right now two things. I can accept it, just go on with my life and try to do something as a teacher, or I'm going to try to change it. kind of try to fix the problems, why my pupils cannot do any goodbye anywhere, and go into politics. And to be truly honest, Ali, in the past, I really despise politics. I know a lot of it because of my background, but it was not like that. I see myself as, yeah, I'm the guy that's going to need to change it. Still don't see it like that, but I want to make a difference for those pupils and many of them alike, because I know when nobody is going to give an eye about it and nobody's going to do something about it, this is going to continue. And that's why I eventually joined in politics.
I mean, you chose to join the PvdA, the Dutch Labour Party.
Yeah.
You could have joined any other parties. The Dutch Labour Party has been in opposition for many years now. And even when they're in government for a very short time. They have never had a majority on their own. I mean, neither has any party, but they only rarely have been the actual ones in, I think the last prime minister was Wim Kok. So why the Labour Party in this case?
At first, it was not certain to join the PvdA at first place. I know I need to do something, join a party, but the PvdA in the past, and especially with Rutte 2, did not bring about that it was a party for the people, because they made at first the situation of most people not easier, but worse. With the market working on healthcare, you saw really the big problems that were already in some cases that's spreading out, and also went into the health sector.
So this is the time you're talking about during Lodewijk Asscher's leadership period, or before that?
This was in a time with, if I got it correctly, Wouter Bos. And that was why I was not in, if I say it correctly, I don't know for sure. Yeah, it was Wouter Bos. And in the time, I really was thinking like, yeah, I don't know if I want to join a party like that. And in that time, indeed, it was already, we had Linia, we had, how do we call it?
Leon Plumer?
Yes, Plume indeed. Yeah, and she was the leading head. And it was not like, yeah, that's somebody that has the same opinion as me. But then I have a really interesting talk with my grandparents. They are in the age, in the end of their 80s right now, almost in their 90s. And they both of them still remember the Second World War, because they were born in that area. And what they told me that was really particular with it. And they say, my grandmother started with a line that still remembers me and maybe even haunts me today. Because what she say was the struggle they have right now was at the past our struggle. After the Second World War, we had nothing. We were all impoverished. Your grandfather, both of them, we didn't have any shoes even for ourselves. And when the politics changed after World War with Drees and also later with DL, that was why we risen up. And the fight the people right now in the south of Rotterdam and many other parts in our country are still fighting for is not different of the fight we had after the Second World War. Because we need to go again to distribute the wealth, think about everybody, and not only say that our country is a haven for wealth and it's a fantastic place. And that's eventually the reason why I joined PvdA. Not because what I saw in the present, but what my grandparents and also me the knowledge of the history of the party told me about what the party is all about. And that was the reason why I joined him.
That's incredible. So it's always incredible to hear these legacy stories. And one of the key things I would reckon about the time we live in, especially in the Netherlands at this moment, and Europe on a wider scale, is who inherits the legacy, post-World War II legacy. And you see who, and what I mean by who inherits that, you see a lot of policies and a lot of benefits of policies came about economically from the left or from socialist governments across Europe, in the UK as well, that established the foundation towards bringing about a much more equitable, equal society, one in which we don't leave people behind. And you find halfway through, so around the 70s, 80s, that starts to erode and starts to be a, you know, starts to be decreased until today, where people, the people benefiting are less than everyone, but they are still the more than the minority that is suffering. And that's where you find who inherits that legacy is day by day becoming much clearer. And that's why, if you look at the differentiation between the left and the right in the Netherlands, for example, it's important that if we continue on the trend that we're on now, we may lose a lot of these rights that are just considered just, you know, just a standard part of our life in Europe. We start losing them because we just forget that who is the party, who is the group that is worthy enough to inherit the fight of for that legacy, of that legacy. I completely agree with you about the, when you get in touch with that depth of history of the Labour Party and the Labour movement, the socialist movement, you start to realize a lot of what we have, including economic benefits that benefited even the wealthier parts of the community, come from policies of better worker rights, wider education, high standard of education. All these things came about not because the wealthy paid for it, but because we stood in solidarity with each other to build on. And then it comes to what we have now. The red-green or the PvdA Groen Links cooperation. In Zeeland, you pioneered that cooperation. You were one of the first provinces and you were one of the people who were instrumental in developing that cooperation. Some people see that cooperation as a threat to the legacy of the labor movement rather than a furthering of. Tell us about some of the struggle to bring that about and some of the critiques that you've had to respond to.
Yeah, first, I'm gonna start with why I, at the first place, joined the Green Party as well. After the election of my municipality in Tolen, I saw that we worked together with the Green Left Party. But what I saw in early stage, everybody has some kind of imagination about the Green Left Party that they are Salon socialists. They are very well getting by. They only think about green problems, not the socialist problems. So they are more like a green environmentalist. But that's not the case. What I saw at very early stage in my municipality, it was that there were people like us, but they were not focused as much as on the people, but more on the planet side. And from that point on, I was sitting like, yeah, we can take a look at the difference that we have. Yes, you're far more focused on environment than we are. But you also have the same ideas how our government needs to fix things for also the population. Needs to jump in to get away with the gap between the growing gap between the rich and the poor, inequality in our student system, and many more things. So it was not like it was very soon. I saw that there were not a lot of there were differences, but they were not that great as I thought before. And that's why I really soon joined the Green Left Party as well. And what happened then in our province of Sealand, because now it's going to get really interesting, is that I was not the only one that saw this happening. Because after the elections, what we saw was that in the cities where we were have a combined list, in the city of Goes, Middelburg, and many other areas, we grow quite significantly with 2 to 3 seats. And in the areas where we stand alone, we didn't even grow or sometimes even get it, lose some seats. And what happened then? It was some of our members in the LV, that is the where all members get with each other. He said, yeah, let's start a research why we are working together and how they are working together and what are the key notes to working together. Because after a year, we even will have an opportunity to maybe do it on a provincial wise. So we start the research with it. And
so just to clarify, so
yeah,
there were people on a local level within their own councils, gemeentes, or boroughs, mm-hmm, who collectively came together and worked on a joint list. And those ones were far more successful in gaining,
yes,
seats. And those where the Green and the Green GroenLinks and PvdA stood separately, and that,
yes,
that then triggered the whole provincial level to discuss, wait, maybe we can learn from this.
Yeah, and but not even there was only the beginning, because after we researched it, and I was one of those guys that joined in the research, we were talking with some principalities. So like I was talking with the people in Zeeuws-Vlaanderen and Schouwen-Duiveland, and they both have a totally different relationship to GroenLinks. And what you saw, it's quite right, was if you want to have a successful cooperation with each other, you need to have three simple things combined with each other. One is the people need to like each other. Simple as that. If the people despise each other, you cannot cooperate with each other. It's really, really simple. The second one is position. If one of them is in the coalition and the other one is in opposition, yeah, working with each other is going to be really difficult. But if the party that is in the coalition sent out his hand, then it's possible to work with each other. Only then. And also the content, that's the third one. And when the research was done, we saw it. And I first came to the Wally Beckman Stichting with Floris and Metin, and I showed them our research. There was the same time that the research from their side was done, and we combined our research together. And what we saw there was that we both look at a different angle on it. They look more on our voting constituency. So if we work together, do we get more votes? Yes or no? And we work more, our research was more like, if you want to start a cooperation with each other, is it possible? What do we need? And what we saw, what I saw in that moment, and also the Wally Beckman saw in that moment, was that if you combine those two researches, you can see that working with each other was not in the best, in the worst interest of both parties. Because yes, maybe we're not getting more votes, but what you get is a very strong structure with people working with each other to get their points into politics finally realized. And that was why we put it on a vote in our province of Zeeland. First with PvdA, we had a success rate of 85% that giving the total cooperation mode. So it was like combined list, combined program, even a combined membership possibility. And on the other hand, the Green Left Party did the same. And so the first step to working with each other was settled. And from that moment on, our two boards, our two leaderships in our province were talking with each other. And very soon they figure out, yeah, it works quite well, because in the province, PvdA and the Green Left Party already work with each other.
Yeah. So, I mean, you touched on something very interesting here. You touched on the power dynamics in each that depend on people, where one is higher than the other in terms of political status, where one group is excluded and one group is included within government. All of these things are very complicated on their own. Is it helpful, or was it helpful, that the national party on the national level was encouraging or giving permission? Because I think at that time it wasn't such clear now. We're talking maybe a year and a half ago, where now today we have parliamentary level one list.
Talking about almost a year ago right now. It's not that long ago. And at the beginning, they were really not ready to say, yeah, it's nice. They were like, oh, you can't try to do that. Okay.
This is the national party level, yeah?
Yeah, the national. Yeah, we need to think about that. So we will get back to you. And then there was the first chamber corporation. And when then...
it's like the senator's equivalent.
Yes, of, agreed. Yeah. And when they when they agreed on combined lists and everything, but at the end, the combined list didn't get out. So, but... after that, we received a green light, and then our confirmation started. So we had 10, and that's now that's going to be the very weird part. We had 10 approximately 2 months to come with a combined program that was never written before, with a combined list that never happened before, with our points that we want to bring out into the election that we didn't have in the election before it. So we had like 2 months to get a whole new kind of political style ready.
And of course, that's new for the electorate as well.
Yes.
How was their initial response to that? Was it positive? Was it skeptical? In terms of your discussions with people on the ground, when you're talking to them in the markets, when you're talking to them on the streets?
Yeah, this what happened with the electorate at first place. But before we're going to talk about it, I want to also talk about something else. But I'm going to answer your question first quickly. They were happy. Seriously, I was walking in, and I still have it, in a jacket with the two parties combined. And it was not like a fair jacket with green, red. No, it was a red jacket with two names on the back and two names on the front. And what you always see at the first time when people talk with you, yeah, well, that took you long enough. That was their first reaction. Like, yeah, all right, now we are here, so... yeah, you want? Where do you go to vote on? And what we saw in the big cities was that a lot of people were really positive about us, coming to our stand, and even other parties. At first, the big conservative parties that are now ruling our province. Those parties at first were really skeptical at first time. They were like, yeah, you're going to break up. Yeah, it's not going to work anyway. Yeah, we like more to work with the PvdA than the Green Left Party. So, yeah, why don't you drop that, guys? But we still keep the confidence and the consistency to still work with each other. Whatever they did. Also, when the two PvdE members, there's a group, came knocking on our door and saying, yeah, you need to stop this, you're ruining our party. That seriously happened. Even from that point on, what happened is that we step by step by step still keep our cooperation working. Right now, we are the second party in our province, but we're in opposition. So, yeah, that happened.
Do you see a future there? A future whereby it's not cooperation anymore, but it's actually a single structure moving forwards, potentially welcoming other groups or parties into the broader church or the broader umbrella of the left or the progressive left?
I truly hope that it happens, but this was the first big step. It's going to take some time to make this even to a success that it's going to be right now. Because what you see is that on the PvdA party, but also on the Green Left party, there are a lot of people that from power base really love to see this implode.
Mm-hmm.
On our different parties, but also in our party themselves. This happens in both of their parties. There are people that have the feeling, like you say before, I'm losing my precious party, don't touch it. But let's get realistic here. When our party was first founded in 1946, it has a completely different opinion on a lot of things than the party had in the early 2000s. Does that have the party right now? A political party is something that changes always what they need to be to get their points done, and also which kind of problems are playing that time. It's not that a political party is placed on a rock and is there stands there forever. No, it changes every decade, every time they need to change to get their points into politics, but also get new points that the population ask for into politics.
So when you say new point, the GroenLinks splits from and out of one of the factions that split out of the PvdA historically and became, or some, as in some individuals were started within PvdA and then have shifted many years ago, way before this cooperation came about, who moved to GroenLinks. If you take a step further, you have parties like Denk, you have parties like Bijeen that split away from the PvdA. Maybe the PvdA itself is just not a broad enough, evolutionarily evolved enough as a party, as a structure, to be able to house such different opinions and approaches. And now, when it finds itself at its lowest point, is now reaching a handout to others and saying, oh, please, we would like to join you, or please work with us now.
Yeah, but you can also say, like, our forefathers from the party did it in 1946. They tried to get the... I could first going to tell you the origin story. In the Second World War, a lot of political minds were held captive by the Germans in a hotel in the southern of Brabant. And what they came to in one of those groups were talking. It was not like a prison camp, but it was more like a luxury householding, to not get them involved with the population, but still they need them because they have a lot of networks, money, and all that included. So they keep them not as prisoners, but they were more like house arrest. And what happened is that a lot of different people with political minds from the Protestants, Catholic, liberals, socialists, all went holding there. And they say to each other, we need to have a different view, a different party that combines everything with the Workers' Party.
So let's just be clear. Just before that, the Dutch society was split into
four groups.
Siloed.
Yeah. Sorry? Four groups. We call it the pillar system. Yeah, you have in the Netherlands after Willem the First, our king in 1850, make his new constitution. He said that everybody can have their own religion. It doesn't matter anymore. But the Protestants didn't like that, because right now, on that point on, the Catholics were free to proselyze again, to have a service, to make churches again. So they were really in the moment like, well, this is going to be a problem because now the Catholics are going after our people. So yeah, we need to have a defense system for it. And what they did in that time was quite literally, they made a state inside of a state, because if you were in the Protestant pillar, on that moment on, you can only go to Protestant shops, read Protestant papers, listen to Protestant radio, and even go to Protestant schools. And what happened on that way, the 1970s, when the socialists even get the voting power, they're still trying to keep it like, yeah, we have all those pillars, do not just try to destroy it, we keep it this way. So when the workers get their vote in, that's the moment the socialist pillar got quite powerful, but not that powerful enough, because yeah, one of the socialists, we call him Mr. Troelstra, tried to start a revolution like it happened in Russia.
Bless his soul.
But
on the banners and in the sky.
And on that moment, he was the socialist.
So this is early 20th century. So 1925, yes. I think, or was it 22?
It was 1970. But I'm skipping 70, very fast. In the 1970, what happened was that from that point on, from the revolution that failed, the socialist pillar was completely isolated, because all the other three pillars were like, yeah, the socialist pillar, that's a dangerous one. Don't touch it. Don't get any close by it. Don't get involved by them. But when they were locked up in the Second World War, that opportunity was not anymore there. Because from that moment on, the politicians that were very close, they normally didn't see each other, they were talking with each other. And from that point on, with four different groups from four different pillars, they formed each other and said, we need to make a party that's only for one thing, that is for making the way for the laborer better. That's why our party gets exited in 1946. That's why the PVDA gets its name from. It stands for the Partij van de Arbeid, or the party of the laborers. It's not the party of the socialists. It's not the party of the Catholics or the Protestants or even the liberals. No, it's for all the working people. Now, that's why, the simple reason, if somebody say to you, yeah, my party is holy, it's always have a socialist background, it always was the same, that's not true. The only thing what our party was really good at, and it still is standing up for the man that works from every day and keep our country running. That's what our party stands for.
Yeah, for all, I mean, there's all people in that sense, all people who labor or work to make a living. I think there was at one point we had a whole discussion about as a group, what defines a worker of today. And if I may propose, I think at the time I proposed the idea that it's if you can live without any government support for more than 1 year, and live, I mean, pay your rent, your livelihood of a decent standard for 1 year, then you're not a laborer. If you can survive more than a year on your own, and most people cannot. If without any government support, without any government subsidy, once that year is over, probably way before that year is over, people will fall right back into poverty, will lose their homes, will lose their any form of shelter, support, safety net. And that's why we have those safety nets in place, in order for people not to fall through. Unfortunately, we're in a situation where people, even with the existence of these safety nets, are still falling through. Roy, who inspires you today? I mean, you mentioned your grandparents.
Yeah, it's true.
But tell me more about not just your grandparents, but who makes your heart beat just that little bit faster?
Yeah, I have a few options there. I'm first going to to my personal one. Those are my parents. I come from a family that where my mother was a cleaner literally, that works every evening to clean up offices and sometimes even schools. My father was a factory worker that worked every day from approximately 7 o'clock to five, and therefore they also saw each other like 30 minutes a day. That was
sounds like the perfect marriage.
Yeah, but it was
no, that's not a joke. Come on.
that was not because they didn't like to live like this, but yeah, they had a mission inside of them, and the mission was we need to get by, don't get get into poverty, and also try to get our two sons, me and my brother, to have a better future than we had in our past. Those two people that worked my whole youth, they worked their ass off. Even they get in a divorce because, yeah, when you see each other every day for 30 minutes, it's not enough. Therefore, what happened, they divorced eventually, but they're still trying to get by every day, start work. And those people, my parents, are not the exception. They are the majority. Most of the people live like this. It sounds really weird for most people that have a good job or something. But most of the people in the Netherlands, but also in the rest of Europe, live like this. Working day and night to get by and also try to get a better future for their children.
Mm-hmm. Knowing you, Roy, and I've seen how hard you work and how much you energy you put into the work you do, the activism that you do, I believe your parents should be very proud of themselves for what they have achieved. I don't know your brother at all, but I do know you, and I think your parents should be very proud of their achievement, because surely their work has paid off. And
I hope it is, Ali, but that's the thing. I'm not the exception in this. A lot of people try to get their children a better place and to get a position that they were before. And this is something that is still happening in our country, but also happening on the complete side of Europe. For example, if you see that the people that that come from Romania or Poland, it's the same. It's not a different. Some political parties say, yeah, those are going to try to steal your job. But that's not the case. It's they are trying to get by, get an opportunity for their children to have a better life than they had before. And when it's going to get more difficult, and it's getting more difficult to even get by, and not to give your children any more a good solution, opportunity. Yeah, that is where the real problem starts in. Because right now we're seeing that we are on the tipping point. Right now is if you have a working, let's say 40 to maybe 50 hours a week, it's not enough. Some people even not get by because the electrical prices, the living cost is too high, and even simply the food on your table. And if we don't change that, and that's why I have my activism on me still and try to change it. If we don't change this, some point, more people will get in poverty. And if more people will get in poverty, we also will see that more people will get a real, real big problem, and then we'll get to extreme solutions, like what we see right now in, let's say, Germany, what we see in Italy, what we even maybe going to see in the Netherlands. The extreme right parties will listen to to notice, will speak to them if the way they'd like to hear to, and they will vote on them, and the big extreme right parties will get stronger. It's not for nothing that Drees is one of those people that started the social welfare system, because he saw what happened in the 30s in Europe and also in the Netherlands. He saw what happened when poverty gets too high, and he was also in a position like, yeah, I don't give a damn what you think or what your opinion is or something. Do you want to have a country that supports people? Yes, all right, let's make a deal, work with each other. And that's the same way I'm seeing it. I don't mind if somebody has a very Protestant background or have a completely different opinion, if he still has one thing in common with me, that is like, all people have the right to get by. And if we don't can secure that anymore, then the real problems will occur, like what we see right now happening in Europe.
Mentioning Europe, I believe you have the aspirations to represent Zeeland, the social democratic movement, mm-hmm. on a European level. So you're not only going to be bound by local activism, but taking it a step further.
Yeah, because I see that the problems we see in our country, in our region, doesn't stop at the border. The problems with housing right now doesn't stop at the border. If you look at the Netherlands, it's really difficult to get an affordable house right now. But it's in Belgium, it's the same. In Ireland, it's the same. You can see if the country is very close by with each other and has the international country businesses have the chance to step in, what you see is exactly the same. They're buying up all the houses, giving you a rent of, like, say, 2,000 euros each month, and people will not get by then anymore. And that's one of the problems, but also with working, you see that the working people are getting poorer and poorer every year, but the rich getting richer and richer every year. So that's why I thought by myself, yeah, when I'm so focused in trying to fix the problem, trying to step in, trying to do my thing in my local area and also in the province, if I want to get rid of the real problems that we are curing right now, I need to get involved in Europe. Do I see myself as the best candidate? Of course not, because I'm 29. I'm doing politics for, like, let's say, 2 years. I know not enough about the European Union to maybe get much impact done. But I know what needs to happen, because I come from a family that know that if there come bad policies from Europe, they get hit first. One of those things is like sending in the euro. It was a great solution. Yeah, we have all the same currency now. Hooray, hooray. But my parents and many people like them saw their life savings just get evaporated by it, because the rate of the money that they had before, that's totally different. And that's why we need to seriously somebody that came have the background with euroskeptical parents. I'm not euroskeptical, but because I saw the opportunities and chances that I had, but know why people are euroskeptical. Know why people are running to the right. Know why we need to get involved with the European European Union. Because if we don't do it, if we try to fix it local, the problems will occur maybe around us, and not in the Netherlands, but the extreme right parties will still have their feeding grounds and will still get stronger. And maybe that will even cost, in the long term, the peace in Europe we have for the almost 400 years before the war in Ukraine started.
And then, so on that point, is there something specific in Zeeland that you see that you can have an impact on? That you see literally, like, the impact of a positive impact of cooperation on a European level that can have a difference on your locality? Because most of these ideas that you speak about, they are global, you know, there are stuff that, you know, are all socialists come together, or all ecologists or people who just want to progressively move things forward, need to do? What's specific in Zeeland that you think you want to have an impact on?
As you can see, one of those problems is that our national government right now sees the border most of the times as a problem. They want to put lines on in the sand, like, yeah, if you buy something in the Netherlands, it's way cheaper. Like, if you buy right now an electric car in Germany with the almost 10,000 euros subsidy on, no, you need to pay again taxes on it. They are still keeping placing roadblocks. But what you can see in my province and many provinces alike, that they are in the broader region, why do I need to make a longer drive to go to, like, say, Rotterdam? If I'm very close to Antwerp, I can buy the same things, I can do the same things. But also, in the people like in Zeeuws-Vlaanderen, of the south of Brabant, why do those people need to drive 40, maybe 50 kilometers to go to a school or to the grocery store, where they are very close by still? And of course, the open borders that the European Union give to those people give a lot of opportunities and also get away a lot of those roadblocks. But our government still tries to get roadblocks on. For example, in the city of Dordrecht, you had Geen Moers. Very chemical business that was polluting with PFAS.
That same they are like forever chemicals.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. Yeah. PFAS are the chemicals that you can put on 120 degrees, nothing happens. Froze it with minus 90 degrees, nothing happened, and so on and so on. In Zeeland, it happened on a way and seriously way bigger scale. We have the Western Scheldt, and right now the Western Scheldt is full of PFAS. It doesn't come from the Netherlands, but it came from a business, M3, in Flanders. If we are now trying to fix the problem, because we at Zeeland have a very good relationship with our southern borders, neighbors, but imagine this. What if we and Flanders didn't get by eye to eye? What if Flanders and us didn't really like each other? This is why we need to have a strong European Union. Because if something happens that impacts you personally, your area, but it's in a different country, you need to do something about it. Because otherwise, yeah, why should, like, let's say a country do something about it? Hey, it's not on their soil, so hey, good luck with it. Try to fix it yourself. And I think really we need to have somebody, and it can be me, but we can have everybody else, that knows why this is important, knows why we need to stay in, to keep in this union. Because if we do not, if we listen to the extreme rights and that say, yeah, we need to get off the European Union, problems like this will get very difficult to get resolved. And that's why I think it's very strong to have somebody from a region like where I came from inside of the European Parliament. And not because I'm coming from the province of Zeeland, but more like to have somebody that knows why it's important to have good relationships and also have a common goal with neighboring countries.
Excellent. Where do you get your source of information from politically? Do you read a lot? I guess, I mean, you're a historian. You probably eat books. You don't read books. what's the source? Let's just say, where does it come from?
Where my knowledge of politics come from? Right, yep. Now, you mean? Yeah, I have some podcasts that I listened. I like to listen to BNR most of the times. Sylvia Hake is something that I like to listen to. That's more on the country politics. I also like to listen to Peter Stroikast. That's of Eastern Europe. And because of that, I really think that I know a lot of things that are happening in Eastern Europe and know why it's happening in Eastern Europe. And also, I like to listen sometimes to one of my favorite podcasts. It's Mag Het Iets Minder Zijn? It's a Flemish podcast with two guys talking about things that happened or will happen in the Low Countries, from Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands in that case. And yeah, and if I take a look at the books that I read, when I say that I was starting to interested in politics, I was starting it from the most lower level and getting it to the present day, because I started at first with one of the most famous resistance writers, Machiavelli, with Principe, to know what does politics mean, what are they trying to get resolved by. That I learn of course in my student time, but also later, why the French Revolution happened, what they tried to achieve there, what the different parts were, why Napoleon was so powerful at the late time. And after that, I started to read the books of Marx, of course, but also his counterpart, Adam Smith. Because most of the young people in that time, yeah, they're going to read Marx, yeah, the revolution. But yeah, if you don't know how economics is work and how the liberal people think, you cannot fix it. So that's why I also invested in Adam Smith. But I can keep going on with this for like ages, but I think we've got to get a stop in it. Stop talking about books and podcasts that I listen.
That's amazing. What's your favorite dress in terms of medieval dress or what's your favorite? What's your most kinky one, man? Tell us.
Most kinky one. In medieval times, the thing that I really really like, and it's really really not that popular in normal times. It's not the plate steel, but it's the chainmail armor. Chainmail armor, it's really weird, because most of the times people say, yeah, chainmail, yeah, it's so weak, don't go, it's only for peasants. But really, chainmail is really easy to make. It's really strong. And yeah,
that's the one where like the small metal lockets rings into each other, rings, and you have to almost sew it together.
That's very good with slashing.
I've actually put one on in a museum once. They had one guy was making them. It is heavy though.
Yeah,
it's not it's light.
Really. But if we're going to talk about England, it's the main armor that the Normans wear.
Indeed.
Yeah. And that's something not a lot of people know. In the late time of the Romans, it was also the armor they wear, and it works really quite easily for slashing and stabbing. Only problem is when somebody comes to you with a club or something different with bludgeoning damage, yeah, you're not going to survive that.
See, that's how I know you like politics, because you like it really heavy. And you like you like the weight of the world's problems on your shoulder the whole time as you, and then you like to be stabbed and slashed around, yeah, and you hope to survive. Roy, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it, and I hope you enjoyed this.
Thank you very much.